New to me.
So we've got that sidewalk. You know, I mean, there's many out of water. We need more.
How are you, Mr. Chairman?
8-6.
I thought you weren't going home, Sparky. I didn't think you had anything to do this afternoon.
No, she scheduled an energy hearing.
What did she do that for?
I don't know.
Keep him here.
Yeah. God dang it. I got stuff I could do.
Go to woulda, shoulda.
Right.
It's good. Does that mean we get to sin?
They must have heard I was gone, so here they snuck in. You know?
I can't see.
Jeez.
But I'm not sin. No, it's a... Yeah, is it on there?
It's on the web.
Okay.
Pardon me.
It's going to be good. Yeah, you might need some caffeine.
That's what I love to.
It never hurts. Did you?
I will do that.
Yeah.
Four times.
Right, yeah.
But he's doing good.
Oh, really?
My Uncle Ray.
Sometimes it's tough to get kind of... Good afternoon, everyone. It's February 2nd. We'll call the meeting of the Agriculture and Rural Economies Senate Committee to order. First off, I will mention that we like cell phones, but we don't like to hear them. So if you've got them, put them on, either shut them off or put them on mute. And we certainly don't want to get involved in your conversations with that and distract from the committee business. So it's time to talk about cell phones and get that squared right from the start. Today we have the honor of having the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in to visit with us about compliance and enforcement objectives and enforcement tools and calculating penalties and that sort of thing, talk about feedlots and other issues that may come up, but we are going to concentrate that on the agricultural issues in feedlots. Some of you in the audience are aware that last week, the governor, the USDA, and the federal EPA signed a memorandum of understanding agreement. We're not here to talk about that today, so if that's your intent, that's not what we're going to visit about. There'll be another meeting or two later on about that once the Commissioner of Agriculture figures out how he's proposing to move ahead with that. So, again, today we'll concentrate on Pollution Control Agency in relationship with agriculture and how we can support their efforts to keep agriculture strong and growing and encourage folks to support the agricultural industry here in the state of Minnesota. For public testimony, we have several of you that have indicated you'd like to speak. If you do wish to speak, please contact our staff up here at the table. My intention is, as usual practice here, that those folks that travel from some distance away, we respect that and want to have you have the opportunity to serve, to testify. And so if you have a concern about traveling some distance away and we get under a time constraint, make sure you let us know that the usual suspects that we see around here every day, we can visit with you as time allows at an additional meeting if needed. So with that, I'm honored to have today Commissioner Paul Austin, Galen Reitz, and Jeff Connell. And I appreciate, gentlemen, your efforts coming into my office last week and talking with me and my staff about how we can work together and how we can get an understanding among the committee members and the public of your objectives and goals and your enforcement plans and all that sort of thing. So, Commissioner, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. For the record, my name is Paul Austin. I'm the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And
My part in this conversation is that I get to do what commissioners do. I get to talk a little bit at a higher level and kind of set up a frame, talk a little bit about how our work connects in through our permitting improvements that we've made, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Reese and Mr. Connell to talk more about the program specifics. Just for starters, I just would like to say that commissioners always wear two hats. We advocate for our agencies and help our agencies carry out their mission. We also act as an advocate and a member of the administration. And, you know, the administration's highest line strategic goals are to put Minnesotans back to work and make government work for Minnesota. People often ask me, where's the environment in those statements? And I would just like to point out on up front that, you know, we definitely have a role in those two statements. Obviously, making government work for Minnesota is a big piece of what our business process improvement and permitting improvement is all about, and that also happens to help the business climate. I'd also like to remind folks that under the business side, businesses open, expand, and stay in Minnesota for three primary reasons. There's access here to an educated and very capable workforce. There's clean water in Minnesota, and there's a high quality of life. So clearly the Pollution Control Agency has a role in the quality of life. We also have a role in clean water. And we also have a role in an educated workforce, and that has to do with the work that we do protecting human health. So environment is in there. It just doesn't say it right up on the front. So that's how our agency fits into the bigger strategy and the bigger goals of the governor. I'd also like to just make a point that a lot about how we think about environmental management is based on an old way of thinking about environmental management. It's really based on this concept of gravity. We throw garbage into a ravine or a pit to get it away from us. We get water away from us, let it run downhill, whether it's in a pipe or a ditch or something else. Where we don't want it, we try to get it away from us. Even air pollution is based on gravity. You fire it up a stack and hope when it comes down, it's far enough away from you that you're not worried about garbage anymore. And what this points out is that our command and control structures are all based around this way of thinking about getting something undesirable away from us. And one of the things that we're doing in the agency is working really hard on the prevention side as well. If we can avoid having the problem in the first place, we don't have to worry about getting it away from us. So these are some of the big frames that the agency is working in. We have a core regulatory function. That's what gets talked about a lot. That's what we're talking a lot about here today. We do have an assistance function. All of our regulators and all of our technical assistance people spend a lot of their time helping people deal with environmental management issues. We like that role. That's an easier role for us to be in than that of a regulator. And we structure our world around that premise that we want to work on prevention and assistance up front to try to avoid problems on the backside. It shows up, and you'll see it show up in Mr. Connell's numbers. It shows up when you look at the number of staff that are actually involved across the agency in compliance and enforcement actions. It's only about 10% of the agency staff that actually do that. So that's a frame that I think is important to keep in mind. The other is the partnership frame. We work in partnerships all over the place. We have a partnership with the federal government, a partnership with the counties, partnership with the cities. We have partnerships with regulated parties. We have partnerships with associations that represent regulated parties. We have partnerships with the public in as a general whole. And we do need to spend time and energy on those activities. I think it's fair to say that over the last decade, all of state government has done a poor job of maintaining partnerships. We recognize that coming through the door a year ago, and we're doing our best to rebuild these partnership bridges in every sector, in every part of the state. It's just part of how you get humans to work well together, and we recognize that and are trying to be part of that. The other thing that I'd just like to remind folks is that our agency is a technical agency. We've got a lot of engineers and scientists and technical experts, and we do our job by going out and trying to get the facts. We want to make science-based, research-based decisions on what is needed to protect the environment, have a public debate about those issues, set standards, goals, practices that will achieve those, and then go back out and see how we're doing. And this fact-based approach is something that has served all of us in this country well with environmental law over the last 30 years, and we fully intend to continue that. Just to put this particular conversation around feedlots in context, you know, we do work for air, land, water, and people. And on the air side, we deal with things as disparate as the attainment of ozone and particulate standards in the metro area to dealing with the question of how to convince people that using burn barrels to burn garbage in your backyard across greater Minnesota is a bad idea. Huge range of activity there, huge scope, not very well related to each other. But those are pieces of the puzzle. On the water side, the chair talked a little bit about the work that we're doing in partnership with the Department of Agriculture, but we have to deal with things ranging from Lake Pepin to wild rice to our partnerships with our counties with individual septic systems. So, again, quite a scope and range of activity. On the land, it's everything from worrying about how much more garbage we're putting in landfills right now. This state is landfilling more garbage than it ever has. That's not good. To things as narrow-focused as whether or not you can build a stadium up in Arden Hills on top of a piece of land that's contaminated. So those are kind of the scopes and ranges, and we're focusing in on one slice of that puzzle here. I'm going to talk a little bit at the start of this presentation about how we're doing against the permitting efficiency law. Essentially, this law set up a 150-day goal for us to be issuing permits, and this goes across all the media, all the land, air, and water permits. We were asked to make sure we could have electronic submission of permits and environmental review documents. We needed to put a process in place to determine application completeness within 30 days. The purpose of that was to ensure that the applicant wasn't left hanging for long periods of time, not knowing what we thought about whether they had the information that we needed. And we were asked to compare proposed changes to standards, to federal regulations, to neighboring states, to other states within EPA Region 5. It also allowed water projects, specifically those with NPDES water permits, to be built prior to the receipt of the permit. This was in alignment with federal law, to allow the project proposer to prepare the preliminary draft EIS. Requires RGUs to make decisions on permits within 30 days, again, a 30-day trigger to allow things to keep moving, and allowed some of the appeals to go directly to the Court of Appeals instead of the district court. That was kind of a long-standing change that was needed in some of the legal mechanisms. So what did we do as part of our role in this? And this law affects our agency, Department of Ag, DNR, a little bit in health, but we obviously were a focus of it. We went through a process internally to amend rules to allow us to hit these targets. We've been working with the chamber. We meet with them at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, working through these issues on completeness. We set up an entire new data tracking system to ensure we knew where permits were. We had a decent one before, but it's a whole lot better now. And we had a first semi-annual report on how we're doing in August, and we actually released another report yesterday, the first annual report. And this is some of the information on how we're doing in this world based on that annual report. Since last March, we've received 2,658 permit applications. 5% of those permits, 125, have been returned as incomplete. There was a few that were withdrawn by the applicants. So we've processed just over 2,500 permits in that time period. 84% of those permits have been issued within 150 days. And if you take a look at a subset of that, 1,632, these are the construction or priority permits. We have made a deliberate choice within the agency to spend more time and energy on permits that lead to expansions or new business or allow a business to continue to operate than we have for standard reissuances, which don't change the environmental or economic footprint of the business. So when you look at that zone alone, we're up at 99%. And if you take a look at the number of permits, for example, that have exceeded 150 days, there have been 67 of those out of the permits that we've got in these construction zones. Most of those are extraordinarily complicated air quality permits. We have not collectively, and by collectively I mean between the agency and the regulated parties and the public conversation, been completely able to figure out a way to get some of these complicated air issues done in a shorter time period. It involves a lot of complex technical modeling, and that's often where the discussion takes place. If you recall, federal air standards are set by the federal government, and so there's a federal protocol that you have to follow in and underneath this as well. Right now, we do have a few permits that are sitting in-house that are over 150 days. Some of these are conversations that are ongoing with applicants. Often you will see in a situation like this that an applicant has changed their project design. Often that's an issue we have to circle back on. And we do have some permits sitting in-house that haven't hit that 150-day limit yet, and obviously our goal and plan is to get them out at the time. I think you have some questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. Yes, we do have a couple of questions. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Commissioner, on the air permit, or air quality permit applications, can you give me an example of some of the applications, what type of industry?
Yep. It ranges from small scale. It could be small point sources, small manufacturing, small facilities that use solvents, VOCs, coatings industry. Those are on the very small end. The big end is stuff as complicated as electrical power plants or the Hennepin County incinerator. Those are on the very large end of that process. There's also there are some specialized issues that I need to point out, specifically often up in the northeastern Minnesota, when you have air sources that can create a haze issue in Class 1 wilderness areas like the Boundary Waters and some of the federal land that's up there. That's another very complicated subset.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, the EPA rulings that are coming down on that, how complicated? Are you starting to look at those right now? And is that even going to further complicate the air permitting applications?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, what Senator Rosen is talking about is there's a kind of a series of EPA regulations on air quality that are staged to come out over a period of time here in the future. They have not come down yet. We are the only state in the country right now that is actually working with EPA to model the impact of these stacking air regulations on regulated parties. That work was supposed to have been completed in December. EPA is actually funding the modeling work and the investigatory work that's going on with that project. But the project is more complicated than was initially assumed. And so EPA's modeling took a little bit longer. And we're anticipating in the next month or two we'll have a better answer to your question of what will this mean to a regulated party going forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I really applaud your prioritization and focusing on those new business expansions as far as where you're going to focus your energy. I just have a question in regards to the metric that we're using to look at how quickly, what percent of permits are being awarded within the time frame. I'm just wondering if there's another proxy that we should be looking at, and that is if there's some way to measure the number of jobs that are being held up. Because it's possible that while 99% of the permits were issued within the time frame, maybe the 1% might have 500 jobs attached to it. And so it just seems that it might be helpful if we were able to look at this data, if there was a way to look at it in terms of how many potential jobs are with each permit that hasn't been issued, or how many jobs have. I just think it's another way that we need to look at that.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's an interesting suggestion. One thing to point out is that these numbers are overall across all the types of permits we get. So we can actually go in another layer, and it actually does this in some of our reports, where you can look at, for example, construction stormwater permits, which are directly related to construction on the ground, and those we issue in about 4 days. And some of these really complicated air permits move out into that 170-day zone. So even within the zones that we currently have, you can get a feel for what kinds of jobs might be affected by our activity. We don't get a job number in with the information that we get on a new proposal. However, with the Minnesota Business First Stop work that we're doing in coordination with the Department of Economic Development and with Commerce and with the IRRRB, there might be an opportunity there for us to marry information they have with some of our information to give another perspective on this as well.
Senator Nelson?
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I would like to see that. I think that would be really beneficial to tie the potential job numbers into your, instead of a percentage rating, out of how many jobs we're looking at. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Benson? Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I am not aware of metrics quite like this from our neighboring states or from the other Region 5 states, which are states we regularly interact with. We can check on that, I'm not aware of that. In terms of the iterative process, two things are important to note here. This agency started working on improving permitting processes about 2002. There was a big backlog of water quality permits at that time. And the reason I raise this is that this institutional drive to improve the business process has been going on for about a decade. And you're seeing some of the end results of that when you can get up to close to 100% on priority permits. So that's good. And we do have an iterative process within the agency for improving our business process. It's ongoing. We've actually retargeted that process. It had been doing lots of little projects the last couple years, and we are bringing online some bigger, higher-profile projects. One of the things that is lurking in the background, the data systems that our agency operates on, they have reached the end of their functional life. So we are going to go through a process in the next couple years here. We will let this Delta database system sit there. We'll continue to use it as we start to migrate toward and build a new data system. And that will be very helpful because, as we all know, how we handle information and move it really can speed up what we're doing and give us a better feel for where the breakpoints are. So we are also looking at that underlying system and process as well.
Senator Dames?
Well, Mr. Chair and Commissioner, could you give me some idea? We're talking about the 150-day frame. You're showing us the percentages, this and that. Can you give me some idea of how old some of the permits are that you have that have not been issued yet? Give me an idea what's the length in days that some of those have been that are still there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, in terms of permits that haven't been issued, you can see the two rows at the bottom. Those are complete applications that are sitting in-house. So there's 175 that are over 150 days, and we're sitting on 236 that we haven't hit that target yet on. Most of the ones that we haven't reissued that are in this standard reissuance category are air quality permits. They continue to stand. They continue to hold that business to the same conditions. So there really are no permits right now, aside from the applications that you see here, that are waiting to be acted upon. There's, you know, roughly 400 there that are above and below that 150-day target, but there's not another stack of permits out there. We're very fortunate that federal law allows current permit conditions to continue in the air quality world. Otherwise, we would have a different situation on our hands.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Senator Dames.
Of the 175 that are in-house at over 150 days old, can you tell me how long, what the days of the oldest one is? Can you give me some idea how long some of those are still there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, I don't have that in my head. Okay. It's in the report, and we will get you that report. Part of the requirement of House File 1, the permitting streamlining law, was that we document the reasons we don't hit 150 days, so all 175 of those cases are documented, and we'll get you that straight away.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Senator Scoy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Looks like you're doing good work and making progress. My recollection is that some of the difficulties that the agency had with the timeline on issuance of permits was that there would be a operational permit issued at the same time the construction permit was being issued previous to this. Can you talk to me a little bit about where the agency is with that and if you are making some changes? And I see there's some construction allowed now with water and can you talk about that a little bit?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, there's two pieces to that world. One is the water side. So under federal water law, you can start constructing before you have a permit. State law until last year did not allow that, so we made that change. So there is an ability to kind of separate operation and construction on the water side. Federal air law does not allow you to do it the same way. And this state has always issued the operating permit and the construction permit concurrently on air sources. And we've talked over the years, and we had another debate this last year, in, you know, as to whether we should continue doing that or not. The risk you run by doing them separately, and this is an issue that Iowa has run into, is Iowa will issue, particularly for some of their smaller air sources, a construction permit very readily. And what they find then is at the end of construction that what's being constructed won't meet the air quality requirements, so it forces that party to go back into construction. And we think that risk is too high. We think we can be fast enough on the front end to mitigate that risk on the back end. So we have chosen to keep those together at this time.
Senator Scoy.
And so, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, so that really isn't a holdup on the 150-day guideline, you don't think?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, no, it's not. We can, you know, most of the time, and almost all the time for the priority permits, we can put them in that box and make it work. The real key to this whole process goes back to that assistance and partnerships piece of the conversation. The better info we get on the front end from the applicant, the better our communication channels are, the faster it will run on the backside, because you don't end up missing pieces and then having to send things back. That's always been a problem.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Commissioner, I know on these complicated and sophisticated air permits that they're a problem. And I guess the question I have is, number one, is the EPA, do the EPA have the experience that is needed, number one, to help you with those? Are they stepping up and helping you with those? And do we have a uniform enough set of expertise and rules to help us compete with other states? For example, when I get calls and companies said, by God, I'm not coming to Minnesota and doing a thing again. And, you know, well, if they're the same rules in all the states, you know, that's something we need to know. So that's the – and then – well, then I'll have a follow-up, too, but if you could address that, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of the unique features about Minnesota as far as how it relates to EPA's jurisdictions is we're actually bordered by three EPA regions. And so Wisconsin is in EPA Region 5. That's the same region we're in. But Iowa's in a different region, and South Dakota and North Dakota are in different regions. There are some regional variations within EPA as to how they implement or what they ask for in terms of some of their air quality regulations. That's an ongoing conversation between the states and EPA as to how to reconcile that issue. There are some interesting twists on that process. EPA actually took over North Dakota's air program in the last 6 months because they didn't feel North Dakota was actually implementing the federal law the way they ought to. There's some speculation that North Dakota was okay with that because they were having trouble implementing it or they didn't feel like doing that at the moment. But the point is there's a lot of variability in you know, where the future lies on EPA's role in the state because the federal act allows them to come in on top if they need to. Wisconsin, the requirements that are being laid out in Wisconsin on air and in Minnesota on air are essentially the same because of the way that EPA Region 5 interacts with us. It has been said over time that EPA Region 5's air permits sometimes are more complicated than other states, than other regions. We're working with them on that. I think the biggest issue is modeling guidance. And just a quick aside on air quality modeling. Air quality could be measured two ways, right? You could go out and measure real time what's going on in the ambient air, or you can simulate it and project what the air conditions would be. It's very, very expensive for a regulated party to do real-time air quality monitoring, extraordinarily expensive for them to do that. So when the Clean Air Act came into existence, one of the negotiations that was part of that conversation was the ability to use modeled air emissions to take the place of this expensive real-time activity. And so it's the initial option to do air modeling was not, in fact, the first choice of, you know, an environmental science person, because they'd want the real data. That was actually an accommodation for regulated parties to make it easier to avoid this long and ongoing air monitoring expense. So it's intended to be helpful. It's complicated up front, but it does save some conversations 10 years later.
Mr. Chair. Well, thank you. And that, you know, and my next question is, do we have the in-house expertise we need here at the Minnesota Department to work on some of these complex issues, or can you partner with some other states that have, you know, for example, let's just say you build an ethanol plant with these down in Texas, and you come up here and build the same plant. Can you use that information from Texas in their organization if we get into some of these complicated things? Is that possible for you to do?
Mr. Chair, it is possible. In terms of some of the kilns and furnaces that are being used in the iron industry, some of those pilot plants actually sit down in Ohio. And, you know, the experience that's been gained by running those pilot plants is, in fact, applied here. Similarly with some alternative fuels, for whether it's in an ethanol facility or other facilities that are using some heat source, we have research that comes in from other parts of the country that is, in fact, applied here. We do have some extraordinarily competent and well-respected air modelers in our staff. We're very lucky to have them. One of the situations we face, in all candor, is as the economy fires up, and let's all hope it does, you know, we've been sitting in this 3,000 permit a year kind of level here for about 3 or 4 years. Well, if the economy fires up and that goes to 5,000-6,000 permit applications a year, we're going to start to lose ground on these numbers. And at the same time, all those private sector industries that are going to want to have permit applications in and want to use technical expertise are going to hire away our best people. So we're going to be in an interesting situation with having new staff and a bigger workload at some point here in the future. And maybe we'll have a talk about that as the economy, hopefully next year, when the economy is going great guns and we have 5,000 permit applications.
All right. We'll look forward to having you back.
Right.
Senator Kielash.
Can I just follow up on that? Have you started looking at plans to be able to adjust to a larger permit numbers that need to be taken care of? And as far as how many new staff you're going to need, if there's enough scientists available, where would we have to recruit them from? And that, could you just...
Commissioner?
We need to plan ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, we are. We've got a couple things that are going on. Inside the agency, there's a couple of forms of leadership and professional development efforts going on to promote from within or create some capacity within. We do have, you know, a couple of plans in the file drawer for what kind of, you know, staffing we need to assign to these efforts as they start to spool up. The replacing experienced staff is a tougher nut to crack. I think one of the best things we can do is try to ensure that, quite literally, our agency's salary structure is competitive. Because you can get a discount of sorts for a person who's very mission-driven, but at some point there's an economic reality that kicks in there. And we're we're pretty good, but people can definitely get paid more for the same work outside of our agency right now.
And I, and Commissioner, I would throw in that you and I talked about this last week with your staff, and you know, we mentioned the notion of as computer you know,
yes,
enhancements come, that we could do you know, some e-based e-forms kind of a thing as you go through them, and you make a mistake on the application, a red light comes up and the flashing and whatever happens, and you go back and do that, so you don't send in and continually send in applications that are not correct. And so I think, you know, and you indicated that was something you would embrace as we hopefully we see these go on. So, Senator Scoy?
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question on a different subject area, and I see he still has presentation on feedlot and permitting, so maybe before he leaves the table.
Let's continue on then. The permitting, you know, we had a lot of discussion on this, and it's good.
That's fine. Great. So Mr. Chair, if I can, I'll turn it over to Galen Reitz, and he will take you through the next pieces of this conversation, and Senator Scoy has a question before that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and this is a different subject area than the committee is probably working on today, but, you know, one of the issues that's going to impact agriculture is the TMDL and the modeling that the agency is doing with regard to the TMDLs. And I don't know if today's the day or maybe another committee hearing, but I don't know if the commissioner has any comments on that or if we should save that for another day.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think two things. One is I think when Commissioner Fredrickson is ready to talk more about this memorandum of agreement with the federal government, I think that would be a great time to talk even more in depth about water, so we can definitely do that then. I used to do water quality modeling, specifically for the lower reaches of the Mississippi River. A huge advantage that you have in water compared to air is you know where the water is, so you can go measure it. And the body of data that's available to apply in the predictive models is extraordinary. Met Council deserves a lot of credit because they collected a lot of that data, particularly for the lower reaches of the river over many decades now. So with the jaded perspective that, you know, I am understanding, I'm a former modeler, so I like that kind of stuff. You know, it does a pretty good job of predicting how things will work. Is it perfect? No, but it's amazingly good.
Good. Thank you, and I'll look forward to that when Commissioner Fredrickson is here then.
Yep. Senator Coobley. Yeah, we'll have your computer.
Commissioner Hawson, what say do local people have over whether or not a feedlot permit is issued? It seems to me local people should have some say on what kind of area they want to live in. Not every feedlot applicant turns out to be the kind of neighbor they claimed they would be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Coobley, one of the slides that I think you're going to see next has that public process built directly into it. And that is one of the things that I think our agency has to always recognize is we have our technical application of existing law that we're busy trying to implement. We have a regulated party who has an application and wants to move on with whatever project they have, but we always need to honor this public process. That's part of that conversation. So whether it's a part of a permit, whether it's a reissuance or a new one, or whether it's part of environmental review, we have an obligation to create space for that public conversation. Earlier I talked about partnerships. I can tell you that whether it's a feedlot, whether it's a manufacturing facility, whether it's a mine, the entities that have the best success with their request to build, expand, do something different, maintain extraordinarily productive relationships with their neighbors. And I know some of them go to great lengths to maintain those relationships. And I, you know, just from sitting on the sideline watching how that works, that is by far and away the best way to ensure an ongoing public conversation about, am I a good neighbor? And am I going to create issues that you might not see otherwise? We've had a wild winter, right? No snow. We've had dust issues up in mine country that are unprecedented because all that topsoil is freeze-dried and it's blown all over the place. They've, you know, the communities have gotten together with the mines and they've worked it out. And that's a much better outcome than having us try to come in and try to sort it through from afar.
I support that notion, Commissioner. Senator Rosen?
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, you've made some great strides in not only in your approach to these applications and in a timely manner, but I guess my question goes just a little bit farther about if a application is returned because it's incomplete or the person who is applying is struggling with it. Is there an outreach? Because our competitors, our neighboring states, have outreaches. They assist in this very difficult application. I assume it's extremely hard to get it right all the time. And that's what we compete in Senator Sparks, myself. We're competing with a very aggressive outreach program from Iowa, whether it's feedlot, whether it's a biofuels plant, whatever. If they have to apply at the PCA, it's more of a, this is what you need to do going forward, and here is how we can help you. You have to do, you can't hold their hand the entire way, but it is a hoping that you're going to tell me that the department is getting to be a partner and not a kind of a penury type of attitude.
Commissioner.
Chair, Senator Rosen, our permit engineers would rather be a partner. They spend an extraordinary amount of time being partners. Part of the conversation that occurred a year ago with complaints about these delays when stuff was pinballing back and forth between the agency and the applicant was, quite frankly, probably us taking too much time in those conversations and walking back and forth and not having enough clarity right up front about these are the boxes you have to check. So, two things. The suggestion that the chair was making about moving to an electronic system, at least for permits that are more routine, to help create that expert system, augment that with the folks, our staff, having more time then to do the interaction with the applicant as opposed to flipping through pieces of paper to see if they're there, is a big part of it. And then in terms of the outreach, and we can talk about this anytime or offline, I'll stop by. There's two kinds of outreach that go on, right? There's regulatory outreach and there's economic development outreach. And I know there's been some aggressive economic development outreach that has gone on from our neighboring states. And the whole Minnesota Business First Stop is about putting the economic development outreach on the front end and using that as the point of entry to ensure that these other connections, be it for work with my agency or DNR or Commerce or whoever, are made on the backside. We have some veteran staff in our agency who have told me in no uncertain terms that this is the first time in their careers they've seen agencies working close enough that we can actually make this happen.
Wow.
Commissioners are committed to it. We're committed to it. I've been through three administrations now. This is different, and we're making it go.
Great. Thank you. Okay, Commissioner, let's move on and
turn it over.
Get Galen Reitz in here to talk about the water. Senator Dame, did you have a point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Austin, before you leave, it appears that from a business standpoint, as we have agencies communicate and work together to eliminate duplication and things like that, it's much business, better for business. Can you give me some idea what type of programs and stuff you've implemented since the last session to communicate with other agencies, eliminate duplication and things like that?
Commissioner? Mr. Senator Dames, we've got a series of groups now that are working together that were not working together quite the same way a year ago. I've talked a lot about this Minnesota Business First Stop. Within that, there's a mining subcabinet that exists today. There was a mining subcabinet some years ago, but we reformulated that, and we meet regularly. So that's the DNR, DEED, IRRRB, and the PCA all sitting together. Mining companies come in and talk to us. The key staff teams that are working in the agencies are talking to us. Those staff teams also work together on a day-to-day basis. I walked out into the lobby of my office one day, and there was an IRRRB staffer, one of my staffers, and one of DNR's staffers all standing together talking to each other with cell phones to their ears while they were talking to other people back in their agencies. I thought that was a great sign. So that is something that we're working on. We have Commissioner Fredrickson and I sit down every month. Our assistant commissioners that work on water issues sit down at least once a week, if not many times a week. Same with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, same with the DNR. They are all part of this interagency water working group that is very strong right now and doing a nice job of coordinating the work across those interfaces. And then out on the energy side, we have a similar conversation that goes on with the Department of Commerce, with energy resources within commerce, within ag on the biofuel side, and then with us, not necessarily directly involved with renewable energy or bioenergy, but obviously needing to be in the conversation so we understand what kind of regulatory challenges there may be. And there's actually two or three different entities that are working collectively on that right now as well. And this is in addition to some of our massive working groups on the Lake Pepin TMDL, on the wild rice and the sulfate work that's going on. Those are more traditional working groups that would work on a technical matter, and those are very interesting. We have some that are really big, 40, 45 members, covering the whole state and every level of government and other interested party, but we're happy to do that, and it seems to be helping.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. Can you give me some idea of what areas, now that you're having these communications, are there any areas that you have found duplication and that you've been able to eliminate it or you're working to eliminate it? And if so, what areas would that be?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dames, the areas that, you know, the roles of the state agencies and the state level agencies are pretty good at not running over into each other's worlds. I mean, after decades of turf warfare, you kind of know where you work, right? We're trying to actually knock down some of that, but, you know. The place where we tend to find the most overlap is in water, and it starts at the local level. One of our board members, a PCA Citizens board member, is a developer who's done a lot of good work across the state. And he loves to tell me the story about a time he was doing a development in the north side of the metro area, and he had to deal with 13 different entities, and only two of those were state level, DNR and PCA. The rest was an array of cities, counties, watershed districts, and then some sub-districts within those. And right now, we've actually got some work going on in our office, and there was some language in last year's budget bill talking about water governance, water regulatory structure. So we're taking a look at that. I know that the watershed districts and the local governments are looking at that. They've had a working group together for about a year. I'm not sure what the status of that is, but I know they were very interested in figuring out how they could connect those pieces. As you get closer to the ground, you got to spread it out further. So you need entities to do that, but making sure they fit like this as opposed to this is a little bit of a trick. So I think that's probably the best place for us to start the conversation.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Commissioner. Senator Scoy.
Thank you. To that point, Commissioner, on the water, do you think there's any chance you'd make any headway with the Corps and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service? Because from my experiences, they're more of a problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I don't know. One of the things that we're doing in the mining sub-cabinet is creating two staff positions to that sub-cabinet. One is an economic development-oriented position, and that will be housed in the IRRRB. The other is a federal regulatory liaison position, specifically to try to get to some of these issues where you're crossing multiple federal agencies at one time. And someone who's got experience seeing where those overlaps are and trying to address them early. That position is just coming online now. We have some staff in our agencies that have informally done that for years. But this issue of, you know, essentially wetlands management via Corps and EPA is not an elegant handoff, either from the state level or the federal level. So I don't have a prognosis, but we do know that's the place we need to do some work.
Thank you. Mr. Reitz, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the regional division, or the watershed division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And what we're going to do now is quickly go over a little bit about permitting specifically in feedlots, and then we'll go into compliance and enforcement activities. This first slide that's up is just to give you context of the number of facilities in the state. There are about just under 27,000 registered feedlots in the state. Of those, about 4.3% or 1,100, just under 1,200 are the larger ones, which have currently NPDES permits, a federal permit, which those are the facilities that the agency really focuses on. The small and medium-sized facilities are predominantly worked with counties. We have 55 delegated counties in the state. So that just gives you a little bit of context of the size of the number of facilities that we're looking at. To talk just briefly about kind of the current timelines in terms of issuing feedlot permits. On the left-hand side of this graph is the number of days to issuance, which is about 72 days, 29 days to get to a complete application, and then 30 days for public notice, and then about 13 days once public notice is up to actually issue the permit. So within the feedlot program, we're well under the 150-day goal that was set in House File 1 last year. The next slide goes into, on the left-hand side again, is the number of days to permit issuance. Again, 72 days, 29 to get a complete application, 30 days for the public notice, 13 days for the issuance. And then that compares that to permit issuance where there's an EAW involved. And in that situation, we're looking at over the last 2 years, 2010 and 2011, there were 9 EAWs done. The average was 209 days to get to a complete EAW and application for the permit, and then 45 days for the 30-day public notice and then issuance. So it's about 254 days if you include environmental assessment worksheets. And I know that's something that people are always interested in. I'd like to just add a couple of examples more recently, and that's since the two that have come in most recently have actually been completed in from initiation to completion. One was 92 days, and another one was 178 days. And I want to kind of highlight the one that was 178 days was actually done by the producer himself. Ended up contracting with somebody to do some air modeling for him, but he actually wrote the environmental assessment worksheet, carried it through the process. We worked with him to get it done, and it was through the whole process within that 178 days. So I think, one, we've tried to make efforts to improve the processes, and two, I think sometimes, you know, we hear that those are daunting efforts, and yet I think they are doable, and so that's an example I wanted to share.
Okay, Mr. Reitz, just, you know, we have a lot of new members in the legislature, but could you explain to us what triggers an EAW requirement on a feedlot? Then?
On feedlots, basically there are two basic conditions. One is if it's over 1,000 animal units, or two, if it's over 500 animal units, if there are sensitive conditions.
Okay.
In simplest terms.
All right. So over 1,000 animal units automatically triggers an EAW.
Correct.
All right.
To that point.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you. Mr. Reed, is that the potential or the actual numbers?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoey, I'm sorry.
Mr. Reitz, the 1,000 animal units, I remember a couple years ago we had some discussion about whether the 1,000 was on the potential for animals in the facility or whether it was the actual numbers that were going to be on the ground according to the farmer's plan.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoia, it's based on capacity. So it's the facility is designed for a capacity, and so this allows the producer to manage within their livestock management system, whether it goes up and down. It's based on capacity. We rely on standards that are developed by the Field Plan Service at Iowa State University. So it's a common definition, and then there can be some adjustments as far as, you know, we don't count, areas where they're moving animals between pens, hospital kind of facilities, those kind of things aren't included in the capacity numbers.
Okay. Well, Senator Scoia.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Reitz, and Commissioner, it might be something that maybe the MPCA would want to take a look at, because with the significant difference in the permitting timeline, you know, really, if a farmer really is only planning on having 700 animal units, but he wants to build his building so that he can expand in the future, maybe we could do the permitting based on what his actual plans are, with the knowledge that if he does ever expand, then he'd have to come back and do the upgraded environmental worksheet. Would that be something you think the department might be willing to look at?
Mr. Reitz?
Mr. Chairman, I think, we're always open to discussing ideas. The capacity issue is actually a fairly important concept that goes through the air program, the water program, and all of our programs as far as how they're designed, so that you always plan for what is the potential of what would be housed there. I think, you know, there gets to be some real complications if it puts us in the situation of counting numbers and those kind of things. I know producers would rather we're not there. There's biosecurity problems. And what we've found in the past is animal numbers become one of those very contentious issues among the neighbors or other people that are concerned about a facility. And so we've always believed that capacity provides a level playing field that keeps everything equal for everybody.
Well, okay, I understand that little bit of an issue, but, you know, we have a pretty good mechanism in place for counting animals, and if the permit was for 750 animals and he went over that, then he'd be in violation of his permit. I mean, that doesn't seem so difficult to manage.
Mr. Reitz?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoia, I understand that argument. I think our concern has been that it kind of moves us from the planning ahead and prevention and into a compliance and enforcement mode, and we really prefer the planning ahead and pollution prevention to having the enforcement role.
Okay. All right. Mr. Chair, if I could just add a quick comment. The comment that Mr. Reitz made about how this compares across sectors and across endeavors, this notion of, what's the maximum capacity of an issue that a facility could create exists in every one of those arenas. We have a similar issue in the mining world, where you essentially have a size of a furnace and a size of an operation, and that capacity is what creates the space in the public conversation for, okay, this is as big an issue as this neighbor could create for me, going back to Senator Kubley's comment. So I think that's one piece of this that's real important to remember. The other is, currently, we don't get routine reports from producers as to how many animals they have on site. I don't think we're interested in receiving that kind of data. I suspect the producers aren't interested in reporting to us like a wastewater treatment plant does, where they literally tell us stuff, sometimes real time, sometimes on a daily basis. So again, this notion of using capacity as a surrogate for actual numbers does accommodate the producer in the sense that it's a one-time, almost a building code style determination of the maximums that would be in play here. So it's a balancing act between those two forces.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator Kelech?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reitz, I'm not sure I got the clarity when you compared the private sector developing the EAW versus the one the agency doing. One was 92 days, the other was 178. Were you meaning to compare them, saying the agency is was able to put it put this together quicker than the private sector, or maybe I missed. I'm just wasn't sure if that was the inference you were trying to make, or if I'm just trying to get an idea as to what that really means.
Mr. Reitz,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, no, I wasn't suggesting a difference there. Actually, both of these were prepared by private parties that we then go through the review and publishing and public noticing and then the permitting with. I think my main point was that two recent ones have been significantly below the average numbers in the data, and so that was my main point. But the second point was that an individual farmer, producer, developed one himself and did it in less than the average time frame here. So I was just making the point, really, that sometimes we hear that EAWs are so formidable that people avoid them to the point where they don't build the facility that they would really like because they downsize to avoid it. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm trying to make the point that, you know, I think, and we encourage producers to propose and do the EAW for the facility that they want and desire, and that the EAW is something just to be worked through, and it isn't as complicated as sometimes the rumors would imply.
Thank you.
All right, that's helpful. All right, we're going to have to clip along here a little rapider speed here, so because we do want to get into compliance and enforcement tools, too, if we could. So next up we have Mr. Jeff Connell, who's the compliance and enforcement. We're right into you, Jeff.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Jeff Connell. I'm manager of compliance and enforcement at Pollution Control Agency. Before I get into the slides, I'm going to move kind of quickly through some of the overview of compliance and enforcement activities, because my understanding is we want to have a little bit of a discussion of the factors that go into penalty calculation when those are used. And we have some data that you can see as well regarding how compliance and enforcement efforts work related to our regulatory program. Of course, we'll take questions and our compliance and enforcement program at the agency, as you can see, I mean, we have a number
of... microphone closer to you? Yeah, we're getting a little... Yeah,
sure.
Try that.
We have a number... Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a number of goals related to what we're trying to accomplish with this program. I think it's important that when we look at our goals, what we're really focused on here is our efforts involved in making sure that compliance is achieved and maintained. In doing so, we're looking at even how the laws are written, fairness and equity across the programs, eliminating economic benefit from noncompliance. And we continue to, this is important to us, so we want to make sure this is part of the presentation. Penalties are and continue to be a last resort, saved for the more serious violations in those situations that might have had actual economic benefit or other types of economic consequences associated with them. As the commissioner stated, most of our compliance and enforcement staff's time is spent on compliance assistance. This is simply just good government. This is the biggest bang for the buck. Enforcement actions are time-consuming. They're resource-intensive. They are, sadly, sometimes argumentative and difficult. I think that, you know, to our credit, we do work through a lot of difficult situations and end up with a better relationship with a regulated party sometimes because of these. But they still are what they are. We spend our time trying to provide assistance. We go on site if there's technical assistance requested of us. We maintain small business assistance, call centers. I also want to take my opportunity to plug the Green Star program. All facilities are capable of doing self-audits, reporting in if they have any violations, telling us how they're going to fix them. They get a waiver from having any enforcement response from us. We've had this program in place for the better part of 15 years. Proud to say, no facility has ever done a self-audit and resulted in a penalty from the agency. We're very proud of this program. Sadly, we're down to only getting two or three dozen of these in a year. And yet, it's a key opportunity for really any regulated party out there to take some initiative and take their own compliance look at their facilities. we also continue our work on pollution prevention, you know, those opportunities facilities have to get out of some operation or part of their business that, you know, if they can reduce or eliminate that waste stream or that problem area, we can help them get out of a whole field of regulation, and that continues to be well worth our efforts too. Now, when noncompliance happens, quick look at how does it happen. Of course, we receive complaints, competitors sometimes, neighbors, former employees, lots of opportunities. Most of our information, as you can see, is a lot of times coming from the regulated party themselves. There are permit submittals, annual reports. Many times they'll report in, self-reported, if it's a spill or a problem that they've had. Permits and other laws require them to do this, and sometimes even if they don't, they're telling us what's going on at their facilities. We appreciate that. These are all different ways for us to find out and then follow up appropriately. Just a quick look. This is a lot of information combined down to three pertinent statistics for you. But the main point of which is when we look at how the different sectors, the industries regulated in the air, the water, and the hazardous waste fields are doing, generally we find in and around 90% of facilities are in compliance. So every time we do an inspection or a document comes in the door, 9 out of 10, just fine. I mean, I think that, you know, I think we forget sometimes because, of course, I'm here to talk about some of what happens within that 10%. And then within that 10%, the even much smaller percent that actually receive a penalty. And, yeah, we do end up spending a lot of time on those difficult situations. But by and large, you know, the vast majority of facilities in Minnesota are in compliance. They simply need to know what they need to do to be in compliance. They need the tools and assistance. That's what we're really focused on providing. Quick look at all of our enforcement tools. I won't go through each one. We'll talk a little bit about the penalty ones here in a moment. we consider enforcement, you know, a response to a violation across a broad spectrum of activities, most of which, as you'll see, we're spending our time on providing information, sure, letters, on-site inspections, just information about something that happened that if the agency believes wasn't in compliance, then we're going to get that information transmitted to the party, and we're going to tell them what steps are necessary in order to return the facility to compliance. We oftentimes agree with schedules for people. They say they need more time. We look at trying to work out how much time and then boil that down to an agreement. We do have some tools where a penalty is a possibility, those being field citations, administrative penalty orders, and negotiated agreements that we call stipulation agreements, as you can see on the right-hand side. And we'll talk a little bit more about those. Within that administrative penalty order, we have these two main categories of penalties. We say they can be forgivable or non-forgivable. Now, I want to take a moment to at least explain what that means because it sounds kind of odd. The penalty gets assessed. The criteria get applied as the statute would direct us to do. But the default is that the penalty is forgiven if the violations are corrected within 30 days. There are two exceptions to that. If the violation or the violations are serious, and usually to us that means either a significant potential for harm, or maybe there was an actual discharge, maybe there was an actual release involved, that might be seen as something more serious. Or in some instances, although even slightly more rare, we have a repeat violation situation. And if somebody does get in trouble twice, I think it just simply seems to make some level of sense. Yeah, then penalties that aren't forgiven are more common. We do want to point out whether the penalty is forgiven or not, in terms of the use of that enforcement tool, we still require, compliance is still expected. It's necessary. And so the key to that isn't whether they're actually going to do what's necessary. It's just whether they do it within or are capable of doing within 30 days. We've had a question come up, and so we just put it out there, is why are so many of the agency's penalties that we go through this process for non-forgivable? And I think the answer is quite simply, we are only taking the time and effort to take enforcement actions for those situations we believe are the most serious. As when we get to the end of the slides, you'll see that certainly in the feedlot program, most of what we're doing is sending out letters that tell people about the violations, what corrective actions are necessary, that have no penalty associated with them at all. And so the very small handful of enforcement actions in feedlots that go out with a penalty each year are for the more serious situations. So this handful of a slide is the criteria that we use to calculate a penalty. This is a guidance document based on EPA's guidance that they provide to us, expectations they have for us in our delegation, the various programs. The big categories being gravity, and we think of that in terms of, how much pollution, how long did it go on for, how far out of compliance were you, those kind of things. How many problems did you have on site? And we also look at what was the potential impact of the violation. What was the potential harm to public health, to the environment? And was, in fact, the violation irreparable? Is it something, a pile of solid waste out there that you can pick up and put away is different than something that ends up in the air or the water where the damage is kind of done? One of the primary and the first things we look at in a penalty is the economic benefit. We're looking very carefully to make sure that we keep those principles of equity, level playing field, making sure that everybody who's expected to comply does, and nobody saves any money or gains an advantage over their neighbor or their competitor by not doing something they're otherwise supposed to. So the first thing we look at in a penalty is, was there any economic benefit? If you were supposed to build in a treatment system and you didn't for 2 years, well, you may have saved a lot of money by delaying that for 2 years when that same person up the road 2 years ago put that system in. That becomes part of why penalties get collected by the agency. And then we also have a series of adjustments. And these, of course, are all very case-specific, site-to-site look at what's the history of that location, what was the response to the violations this time, or even with maybe a warning in the past. Is the penalty going to act as a deterrent? Not only to that facility, which it probably will, and it's not too happy a day to get a penalty, as many of us know, but also to other facilities similarly situated. We want to make sure that it's providing the deterrence in order to make sure compliance is the goal. We will look at the economic consequences of a penalty. We will look at it. Facility or a company, if they want to present information to us about ability to pay, then we review that information. We look at what costs are associated with returning to compliance. Many times, if there's a problem and there's a cleanup that's associated with it, that cleanup can be as costly, if not more so, than what it would have cost to do it right in the first place. And that really eliminates a lot of the economic benefit that they would have received. And so the cleanup costs alone from not doing what they were supposed to can act as a mitigator for the economic benefit portion of a penalty. We often look at if there are other penalties involved from other levels of government is also a consideration that we have. A lot of these penalties are settlements that the agency is doing. So we often consider the costs of protracted litigation, continuing arguments, and whether, in fact, we can reach an agreement, protect the environment, resolve the violations, get the corrective actions we need, and then move on. These are the goals that we have related to when we decide to assess a penalty.
Okay. I think at this point I'm going to ask the folks in the audience if they wish to testify today, are not able to testify next week if we continue on. Obviously, we're running short of time here. I would like to ask you what your wishes are. If we have folks that wanted to testify today, would not be able to come back, for example, next week after we finish hearing all of this testimony, but if you would be prepared to do that today, because our committee ends at 2:30. We have the room until 3 o'clock, but I'm asking the folks that have driven some distance, I've committed to you to have the opportunity to speak today. So if we'd like to come up and give some testimony today, where we should probably stop at this point, and maybe Mr. Kaufman can come back next Thursday or if that works for you. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask your indulgence, if Mr. Connell can jump forward two slides, that one. I think this is an important contextual slide, if Mr. Connell could just walk through this one in a minute or two, and then we can move on. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of moments about this slide, number 17, that we're looking at, showing the size of the regulated universe of feedlots that we have. We thought it was important to at least point out the number of inspections performed. We're kind of looking at a multi-year look. We are generally only able to see 1% to 2% through inspections of the facilities out there. And so of that 1% to 2%, that's where we extract kind of that 90% compliance rate. it's a very large universe. We have a very small snapshot. And remember, a lot of our inspections are also driven by complaints and other reasons that might pull us to the facility. So we think that's important. And also, although, again, my apologies, this slide is busy, but please, this makes an important point, especially about feedlot enforcement. The acronyms, you can refer back to the page on enforcement tools, but what's important is looking at the numbers, letters of warning, notices of violation, these have no penalty associated with them at all. What we are doing is basically sending a formal letter to a feedlot owner, to a regulated party, saying, listen, we believe these to be violations. They are alleged, and these are the corrective actions we'd like to see you take in order to fix them. Of the three-and-a-half-year window we're looking at, we've issued close to 435 in the ballpark of these types of warning letters. The actual number of documents we've issued that had one of those penalties associated with it was 22, 3.5 years. So at least, before I ended, and I appreciate Commissioner, a little perspective into actually how many of these actual penalty documents in the feedlot world are we issuing compared to just warning letters.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kaufman. Senator Skoy and Senator Kielash, we need to get testifiers up, but go ahead. Senator Kielash is...
I just had a quick question. We're just wondering if some of the penalties are dictated by the EPA on this, or is this just within our own, as far as the severity or what gets penalized? Who's in control of that? I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear on that, but is the EPA dictating what you have to penalize? And
no, Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, EPA does not dictate what our penalties have.
Okay.
I mean, we are subject to their review, and we of course want to satisfy them that we're responding to federal violations appropriately. And we will follow guidelines that they give us and the criteria, but our penalties aren't anywhere near what they would want them to be, nor is that a goal of ours whatsoever.
Yeah. Good, thanks.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Connolly, if you could please, could you tell me how many animal units a farm would have to have if it's close to water to need to register as a feedlot?
Mr. Connell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, I'm not that familiar with exactly how many animal units would have to have next to water. If there's a discharge
50?
To a water, then an NPDES permit is required.
It's like 10 or 50 animal units in order to register for a feedlot? 10?
I think it's 10, Senator.
I think it's 10. Yeah. And if it's a distance from water, it's a little larger. The point I want to make, members, And I was here when this number was set. And I knew that at some point I was going to see this graph with 30,000 feedlots on it. When you think of a feedlot, you think about a facility with a lot of animals concentrated in one area. A lot of these farms that are being registered as feedlots are not what you traditionally think of as a feedlot. They're a pasture farm with more than 10 animals if they're close to water. Yep. So keep that in the back of your head when you're looking at these graphs with this large number. The number of farms that are what you think of as a concentrated number of animals is significantly smaller.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Scoy. Did you have a response, Mr. Reitz?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to clarify that we don't regulate pasture facilities, so pastures are not included.
Senator Scoy.
But they register, and this graph is registered.
All right. Senator Coobley.
Mr. Connell, why is it that when a fine is levied for a second offense, it comes out in the paper the offender has been fined such and such an amount for killing off 7 or 8 miles of a local creek by emptying the contents of a 5-million-gallon lagoon into a 3-million-gallon lagoon? Then when you find out what they actually paid and it's 1 to 10% of the original fine, I can see giving someone a break on their first offense. But on a second offense, that violates common sense, if not the law.
Okay. Senator Connell?
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Connell? Sorry, I didn't want to call you any names. I called you Senator. I apologize.
Mr. Connell, I'd be honored, but no thanks. Mr. Chair, Senator. My job's hard enough some days.
I know.
Well, I do appreciate that. I do. And specifically, you know, each individual circumstance is going to be different. As a general rule, you know, repeat violations should be seen and taken in a more harsh light than first-time violators. And I think that while I didn't bring that specific data element with us today, we do track all of our repeat violations, and so we know which cases we have are subject to that condition. And so it would take a little bit of effort on my part. I would be glad to provide that information to you or to the committee, because I think that it takes a little bit of looking under the hood to know exactly why a penalty went down or didn't and what our response was to that situation. So it's kind of hard to answer in the aggregate, except to say, you know, we stand behind repeat violations usually result in more significant penalties and fewer forgivable penalties than first-time violators do.
All right, thank you. Let's have our testifiers that can't come back at another time step up today and go ahead, gentlemen. Hop up in the hot seat there. And please state your name for the record and tell us your story, gentlemen. Speak into the microphone.
Hello, everyone. I am Nathan Megadance. This is my brother, Tyler Megadance.
You can sit down and give a microphone there. Nathan and Tyler.
If we could,
thank
could
you.
I get a copy of that
paper that she's handing out as well?
Thank you.
And you're from Stearns County?
Yes, that's correct.
From? All right. Thank you, guys. Go ahead.
Well, to start off, we are both sons of a fifth-generation family farm. And we're here to express some concerns that dealing with the MPCA and the fact that we are finding it extremely difficult to financially, mentally, and physically to be able to come back and join the family farm.
Through all the permitting and last 3 or 4 years that we've gone through, it's been a challenge, a struggle. Not only affecting my dad, who I see it just firsthand, but also it comes to us who we want to join. But it's like, why would I ever want to do this when I see all the stress that it's causing him?
I can assure you that everyone on our dairy, and I think the dairy industry in a whole, is very, very concerned with environmental protection, protecting the waterways, and keeping everything clean. We find it very difficult that we were issued permits in the past to do an expansion that would allow the next generation, me, my brother, and possibly even a couple cousins, to be able to come and join the family farm. And about halfway through the construction process and $1.3 million into it, roughly, some of the permits were withdrawn, and it took extensive time period, a number of years, to get back to where we could continue with the process. And that dollar value and that has been some of the biggest challenges that we've faced is being able to stomach that $1.3 million expense that we have not been able to collect $1 worth of assets or income, I should say, off of that. And I don't think it's right. I don't think it's fair. I know you guys have been heard the word fair play as far as fining one person and not the next. And I think that the whole situation is very, very...
It's been very long and drawn out. I came down here on August 11th with my father. We met with Rod Hamilton and the Commissioner Austin, and it just seems like it's just a struggle to get back and forth the communication. And what are we? I mean, what's the goal here? I mean, we just want to farm. Mm-hmm. So that's all our goal is.
And the fact that the permitting was postponed or withheld actually made the risk of pollution much greater than if they would have just let us finish our projects. They stopped. We got one manure storage facility done. They stopped the second one halfway through, and we were not able to get that contained as well as it should have been. And that is totally on MPCA's shoulders. If we would have been able to let the backhoes keep going and finish it up, we would not be here right now. It would be a done issue. And now, 2 years later, now we finally are able to keep going on it and keep the ball rolling. But the past 2 years have just been very difficult financially, mentally, and now we really don't know, are we going to be able to come back and join the family farm?
Yeah, we don't know what the future is going to hold for us.
They've created a big hole to try and dig out for ourselves, and it's a challenge. And I hope that something comes of this, that at least they have to have some reasons and some feedback that we could work through some of these issues instead of putting that kind of financial detriment on any business. It's just not right.
Okay, guys.
Thanks for your time, and have a good afternoon.
So, one question I have, guys, I see in the third or fourth page here that at your dad and you met with Rod Hamilton, Chair Hamilton over in the House, and Commissioner Austin on August 11th, and what's happened since then?
It doesn't seem like much.
Not much.
As I left for college, it was a week before I left for college, and
tell him what he told you that he would do, about him looking into it.
Yeah, they said they'd look into it, and it doesn't seem like much has happened at all. I mean, just sitting on our hands, basically.
Senator Nelson?
Mr. Chair, I certainly haven't had time to digest all of this that I was just handed, but I did skim it, and there's just a couple things that I find rather concerning, and I don't know, maybe you could comment on them, or maybe the commissioner could, but the fact, it says here, the chronic inconsistencies between the MPCA and county agencies, making it impossible to be in compliance, and that's a concern to me if there are inconsistencies and it actually makes it impossible to be in compliance. I think that's something that certainly we would maybe need to look at. I'm on page 2, I guess it is. And certainly we never want to usurp any local control, but it is – so I'm just a little alarmed by that.
I think some of the reasons why that was put in there is because we are going through an expansion, and the county has given us permits to do – certain things, and I don't know how far along in the project it was, but MPCA stepped in and said that Stearns County is a delegated county, and they kind of stepped in and overruled Stearns County's ruling, and so those two were never able to.
If I may, I'm Paul Magadens, and I'm dad of the situation. I've been at it this quite a long time, and I invited Tyler to come. He's thinking of heading into a different direction. He's going to school at St. John's, and Nathan went on to be an electrician, and I'm trying to get them both to come back to the farm. We spent almost $2 million on this move, and my biggest concern is why did we do it? We should have never done it. We should have moved to South Dakota like the better dairymen do and just got on with life. We would have been far better off than to propose any such a foolish move like this again in Minnesota. I would rather blatantly let people know that the moves we moved through were just, I don't know what other word to use other than asinine. Some of them triggered by EPA issues. Some of them triggered by applying for certain deadlines or permits. And them details trump all common sense. The fact is, we had a violation. The violation could have been corrected. It could have been done 2 years. 06 was the day we announced we wanted to catch our first silage juice. After we got all done with our situation, we had a violation. And they knew that we had the potential, but stopped the project on after phase one without letting us finish that next building, which every agency that's involved in it would have said to us, my God, if you would have just finished, you would be not here today. You would not have these issues. It would have been a green light. You should have just finished. I had 3 orders to stop, and as we dug into this thing rather deeply, we realized, oh my gosh, the county should not have stopped. The designated county employee who came out and ordered us to stop flat out told us, we screwed you over, we made a mistake, I apologize. Well, apologies don't work when you have $800,000 concrete box sitting there catching runoff, your cows are in an unpermitted open lot, and they're over there, and there's potential to, and you have in writing from there, that agency, you have it in writing, here's where I think southeast of the buildings, that handwritten note from their notes, you have it in writing that these should be put there until the building is completed. 2 or 3 months, whatever, a year or two afterwards, they take your permits away. Well, then you're going to have runoff, fools. There's no common sense. I believe Paul Austin is starting to do a good job because some of these things go predate him. This goes back quite a ways, our situation does. I'm hoping that sometime I can have a sit down with Paul Austin, and I want to invite each and every one of you to our farm to actually follow one of maybe a 6-year debacle in one of the most bizarre pollution issues in Stearns County. And it was caused 100%, in my opinion, because we listened to the paper rules and didn't follow our hearts and what we knew was right for the environment. I don't think there's one dairy farmer in Minnesota that intentionally or wants to be considered or is a polluter. And I adamantly deny ever polluting when you take one sample, and I heard today that they use good science. And Tyler, what happens in eighth grade when you have one science project? What do they call a one sample? What do they do if it's drastically out of control. Well, what do they call it?
It's an outlier, and after, it's anything. I mean, you put it on a graph, and it's you gotta have more than one sample. You gotta draw a baseline at least. And they found one high sample. Well, what's the average? I mean, what's the median? I mean, where you gotta find that?
They use bad science, bad math, and they continue to use bad, bearing down on me political ambitions to tear me apart. I sat down with Paul Awesome, Dave Fredrickson, a couple other people. I made one silly term. I said one thing. I said, do you want this to be the nail in my coffin? And two people chimed in and said, we take offense to that language. Offense to that language. I'm living this. I lost $526,000. And you want to tell me that saying something like that is taken offensively? Within, I think, 24 hours, I had two phone calls from mental health directors. I applaud the ability that the Department of Ag has under their wherewithal to know when a farmer is under stress or distress. And they called me. I thought you got an excellent thing going there. I think if you want to have shovel-ready projects, all of you need to cut this agency in half and shove the money over to Stearns or any soil and water conservation district that actually have engineers who know how to lean on a shovel and run a computer and design projects that will actually fix the problems. Second, you need to stop monitoring the water all over the place and keeping people that are scientists and too lazy to work and sit in front of computers do easy jobs. Let's get construction going. All right, I'm sorry. Thank you very, very much, and I am engaged, and I'm just wound up. Thank you, and I apologize if I went a little bit too far, but you definitely, every single one of you are invited to look me up and walk, and I would show you exactly where tile limits are. I'd be happy to. We farmed there 130 years nearly, and we'd be happy to. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yeah, if you have more that want to testify, go ahead and come up to the table, and we'll keep moving through, and so we keep clipping along here in the time. Again, I'm sorry for the time constraints, but we're talking about important issues here, folks, and I want to have everyone have the chance to talk and say what they want to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jack Miller. I'm county board chairman from Houston County. And we had, not to my knowledge at the time, but we had some issues with one farm in particular with MPCA regulations. This came to my attention when a number of farmers came to a county board meeting and stated that they couldn't work with MPCA, that the regulations and the lack of communication was making it impossible to do what they wanted to do with their farms. So I mentioned at the meeting that I thought I would contact MPCA and try to straighten some of this out. Much to his credit, Commissioner Austin called me a day or two later after it hit the newspaper, and we arranged a meeting. We met in Rochester with some of his staff and some people from Houston County and surrounding counties. I think that was a good starting point. After that, had a follow-up meeting talking about some of the issues. And again, I am glad that the agency was open to do that. And again, I think some progress has been made. But if you'll bear with me, I want to just quickly read through some of the issues that were compiled by our feedlot officer and our county environmental services director. This is mainly in response to an MPCA letter to Houston County pertaining to the MPCA requirements regarding the administration of the feedlot program by county staff. This letter was issued to Houston County after our second meeting in Rochester with the MPCA staff. After reviewing the January 26, 2012 letter from Randall Huckride, MPCA Southwest Regional Manager, and discussing it with Bob Scanlon, our County Feedlot Officer, and Rick Frank, County Environmental Services Director. It is our position that many of the issues stated in the letter have previously been addressed and most have been implemented by the county staff in the past 5 years. I'm not sure which senator mentioned this, but she said that she didn't want to see the state usurp county responsibility, and I feel strongly that that's what has happened with instances in Houston County. I won't go through all of the verbiage here, but one of the issues was that we were not following using the most current inspection form from the MPCA. There was a form. Our records show that from 2006 to 2010, the county used the MPCA inspection form from the August 1st, 2006 revision. The county used this five-page document to record findings of feedlot inspections until another revision was made on March 4th, 2011. The inspection form went from a five-page document during 2006 to 2010 to a 10-page document on March 4th, 2011. Two more revisions of the form occurred in 2011, with the end document being 12 pages. Little difference in content exists among the three 2011 revisions, with the only substantive changes being the form's format. The county feels the numerous changes from the state have created more confusion with little verifiable improvement to the inspection process. We still contend that we use the most current form for our inspections. Furthermore, it is Houston County's position that even if by mistake an inspection is ever made and recorded on an outdated MPA form, our staff will make sure the inspection is comprehensive and the follow-up with the producer regarding environmental concerns will be addressed. This has been our standard and will continue to be our standard. The county staff feels that during the past 2 years, the MPCA feedlot staff has concentrated less on environmental concerns and more on playing a gotcha game with a county feedlot officer over less germane issues. The January 26th letter from MPCA also lists other issues which we are already implementing. The letter asks for a 30-day response, whereas a few phone calls or a personal visit would probably clear up the issues easily and not come across as being so heavy-handed. At a January 6th, 2012 meeting, the MPCA staff attended by Environmental Services Director Frank, CFO Scanlon, and me were told that Houston County is on probation for falling short on 7 years' worth of reviews done by MPCA staff regarding the feedlot program. However, when a check of the reviews was done, there was no documentation of the county not meeting minimum program requirements. The county has typically received $4,000 to $6,000 in additional grant money each year for performance credits. This grant money is awarded to counties that exceed minimum program requirements for feedlot program administration. Houston County's records do not support the charge of below standard feedlot reviews. Houston County is not asking for preferential treatment. Our desire is for consistency in reviews by MPCA staff and more timely communication of issues that the county needs to address. Houston County has a history dating back to the 1970s of being progressive in the administration of the feedlot rules and has always thought of MPCA as a partner in this endeavor. Over the last 2 years, our relationship with MPCA has soured, and it is our sincere desire to reestablish a positive attitude on our side and hopefully mesh with the same attitude from MPCA. In closing, I'll just say I don't know who to give credit for the quote, but I feel that common sense hasn't been very common. I just recently had a couple issues with two other agencies not related to this, but was told by people who probably are making in the range of $50,000 that that's what the statute says. We could save a whole lot of money in government if all we had to do is put the statutes on a desk, because I can read. But when it comes to common sense, you can't get much out of a book on the desk. You need somebody to use that common sense and tell you, well, the statute says that, but I understand what you're doing, and I think you're in good enough compliance that we can work with you on this. That hasn't been happening, and it's created a whole bunch of turmoil in Houston County that we wouldn't have to have. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Who wants to step up next? We've got a few more minutes yet we can go, folks. But
I guess I'd like to take the opportunity. I'm Mike Engelson from Engelson Hilltop Farms. My issues deal directly with the Houston County thing, or they're totally tied to very much everything that goes on. As you have the sheets here, I'm going to try to read through a few things to see if we can. It's very much on the same turmoil that Paul Megadance is. It's almost retelling the same story that Paul Megadance told. But some of the other issues that I've dealt with was because of people not telling the truth that were relating directly to the MBCA, it involved our neighbor turning into complaints, and we went up to 31 complaints returned against our dairy. And if you talk about harassment, is 31 a magic number or what that we received? None of them were violations that we're aware of today, to this day yet, but that's what we're trying to deal with. I'd like to probably just read through a little bit of this here and then cut me off when you need to, Chairman, that I want to give a little bit of background, kind of where I come from and how I got there. We're a family farm. My dad started farming on the farm in 1966 with 33 cows. I grew up on the farm, worked side by side with my mom and dad since I can remember. At age 8, I lost my right leg in a farm accident. That did not stop me from dairying. To this day, 46 years later, we continue to operate the dairy farm as a family farm. We increased to 400 cows through a series of phase expansions, through 7 phase expansions, so we've done this many times. I've even put on presentations to the Minnesota Milk to this effect, as well as down at the World Dairy Expo in Madison. The rolling herd average is 32,000 pounds. That's approximately a little over 30% more than the average dairy farm in the state of Minnesota. So we are trying to do a very good job at our dairy. Our family employs 13 full and part-time employees. This spring, we're thinking we want to try to bring a third generation member into the operation. That was pointed out earlier with the mega dance. I really, really, really am having trouble right now of saying I want to take this person and bring him in under my wing. Right now, I really think I should educate him and send him to Wisconsin or Iowa or South Dakota, where they do not have the problems that I encountered in the last 2 years of my dairying. In my process of the dairying, I'm going to give you a couple examples. On the onset of the project, certain staff, MPCA, has been intent to halt or compromise. I don't have issues with following the rules and the regulations set by MPC. As a farmer, I earn my living on the environment and recognize the responsibility steps to protect the environment. But I do have issues with government agencies that operate under the assumption that every farmer is a violator of the law. Rather than an agency that is willing to work in good faith for a farmer who is seeking to comply with the law, and I also have the issue with public servants who manipulate policy and procedures to meet their one's own agenda at my family's expense. The following is a synopsis of a long lasting of wrongdoings MPCA had at the Hilltop. There's way too many details here, and I'd rather spend my time if anyone wants to pull anything out and ask me specifically if that would be the best procedure, but I know I could spend 25 minutes here on that, so I want to apologize up front. I want to get to the meat and potatoes, people. So if there's any questions that anyone's looked scanned over and has any questions, I'd like to try to address them. But with these here, I also have my engineer that basically provided documents of 3 other operations that basically validate all these manipulated policy changes and stuff that MPCA has been throwing and giving us to deal with. So they're all documented with emails and effective addresses to accomplish what I'm saying in this letter. So
thank you, Mr. Engelson. I want to congratulate you on, 32,000-pound average is a lot. You're doing it, you're running a good herd.
Thank you.
No doubt about it, and I appreciate your doing that. Senator Miller.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just encourage members to take a look at this. We have 2 more testifiers in about 4 minutes, so I think while they're testifying, we can look through this, and if anyone has any questions, we can come back to Mr. Engelson.
Thank you.
Should I go ahead?
Douglas Gunnick, Sibley County. I'm at the grape table also, I guess. And I'll make it very brief. A lot of details to this. I have a small grass-fed beef operation. It is all pasture. I don't feed anything other than grass to my cattle. I am registered as a feedlot in Sibley County. I told them I did not want to be registered. They went and got a search warrant to come out to my farm. And we've been through some district court battles over this and had information told to the judge to get the search warrant that was not true, and I'm fairly frustrated. When I read the regulations, it says I do not need to register, and I'm not volunteering to unless I need to. Okay. That's all I have to say.
Mr. Gunn, how many cattle have you got?
I got about 40 cows and 40 yearlings.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, sir.
And how many acres, Mr. Chair?
And how many acres?
How many acres is that on?
I have a total of 130 acres, and I use about 30 of that for winter feed strictly. The cows don't go to it because it's along the lake. So the rest of it is pretty much pasture.
Thank you.
All righty. Thank you, sir. Thanks for coming in to testify today. How'd he...
What?
Don't we have anybody else ready to testify?
Well, you know me, I'm a man of few words.
Go ahead, Mr. Kaler. How are you today?
Well, really good. Appreciate you taking time to listen to us. I brought some...
Announce your name.
Oh, Ralph Kaler, St. Charles, Minnesota. As I said, I appreciate you taking time to let some of the producers testify. I think the Megadans and Mike and we got some other guys here that it's their first time. But as farmers, we all want clean water. We're not up here about complaining about having clean water. We want to make that very clear. We live where we work. The Megadans, where their water, they live on the lake. They're the closest people to their point of supposed violation. But our issue is how the rules are enforced and their subjective enforcement. If you listen to the beginning speakers talk, 98% on the compliance, and that sounds good. Thank God most of our businesses don't operate on a 98% success ratio. In my sales business, if 98% was good enough, it'd be fine. But what we're here talking about is the 2% and individual cases with these guys who want to stay on the farm and make 100% of their income. On a personal basis, I don't have an issue with MPCA. It's my friends and customers that were involved. And I got involved with them because I told them the way they were being treated is not the way our government was set up to work, from what I understand. So we've got involved. We've had two meetings at the state, one with Senator Hamilton and Commissioner Fredrickson, I think three of them with him. We've met with Commissioner Austin. And quite honestly, the response we've got has not been acceptable to alleviating the stress on our producers or addressing the concerns they have when things aren't right. And I encourage you to talk and look at their individual cases. When you first hear the data, you do not believe that it can be true. The other belief that I think we step forward is, if the mission statement of MPCA is to make cleaner water, I don't see how they're accomplishing that right now with their approach. Rather, it's more of a punitive approach, and it appears to be a revenue generator. And subjective interpretation. With the Megadan situation, as we look at it, the MPCA Agriculture, the Citizens Advisory Panel member, their local entities, and the MDA livestock team all say that Paul has not been treated right. But you know who he's fighting with now? It's not the local MPCA, as they talked about. It's the state MPCA. They've made some mistakes, but Paul's trying to get it negotiated, get it resolved so he can move on farming, and it has been impossible to get done. In fact, as we look at one, Commissioner Austin, you can probably, Paul heard it, and Mike Mastey, who is the Ridgewater Farm Management, think of us a statement to the effect of, we all know that MPA could write a violation up on every farm you step on. You recall that in our meeting with Paul and something to that effect? There's a violation. I'm just wanting to make sure I'm not putting words in your mouth.
I think he
Well, no, and I think it's important, but, you know, a statement along that lines is somewhat scary. Senator Scoy, you brought up the capacity issue. We were at Minnesota Milk. One producer had to take a foot off his dam to get in compliance in his pit because of a capacity issue. All's that 1 foot it did. Yeah, it did allow him for expansion if he ever did, but you know what? If we get a 12-inch rain like we had in Winona County in 2007, which way protects our water better? Or if we build a 1,000-cow dairy, and you know, if our pit's room to hold 1,500 cows, that's cheap insurance. Extra expense, but I don't know of any business that builds to expansion without room to grow. So I guess if our regulations and relationships with MPCA aren't an issue, why did FarmFest have a panel on it with the title, Is MPCA Out of Control? Minnesota Pork had a panel on it with their producers. Minnesota Milk, Mike got the group. We had over 20 producers in there. And the Minnesota Cattlemen's has also had the same thing. We've got some serious issues with their treatment and on-farm support with individual producers.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kaler.
Thank you.
Next. Environment Committee has moved to room 15, so we'll announce that now. They were going to meet here at 3 o'clock. So, again, I apologize for running long, but, again, important business, and we want to have folks have their say. So,
get the page.
Sir, go ahead and state your name. And
good afternoon. My name is Dwayne Wirt, co-owner of Wirtland Holsteins, Lewiston, Minnesota, Winona County. I know I don't have time to read my whole paper, so I'll just read briefs of it. If family farms are going to continue to exist, they must be allowed to grow. Rules, regulations, the permitting process have not only made expansion difficult, but even maintaining and presenting farming operations challenging today. Our farm is over 156 years, and this is the sixth generation of Wirts on the farm. By the 1970s, we were milking 60 Guernsey cows, sold a few bulls, grew 300, 400 pigs a year, and farmed 400 acres. Through careful planning, long work days, our parents managed to help their children continue to farm. We are presently planning for the next generation. I have two nephews presently working at the farm. My daughter intends to come back when she finishes at the University of Minnesota, the veterinarian program, and I also have another nephew interested. As you can see, this probably won't support the future. We started our planning in 1996 with a parlor, new barns, etc. Got the permit from the MPCA at the time. But one guy at the MPCA held up our permit at that time because he was on vacation. He had it 3 months, go figure. Then we had other phases, as you can see, as we go through. Then if you look at phase three, 2003, 2005, because our farm was over 300 animal units, we were required to file a detailed nutrient management plan. This was completed with the help of the NRCS EQIP plan. However, the NRCS plan did not meet the Winona County Feedlot Officer's approval. Some rules at the state or federal level changed the accepted level of nitrogen per bushel of corn produced to 9/10 a bushel of corn produced with a maximum of 180 pounds per acre of nitrogen. This was revised accordingly. However, there was no notice from either the state or the federal government of this fact. And you can go right on through how the new rules and regulations are causing engineering fees, geologists to come out to the farm. We were cited for an intermittent stream violation and a sinkhole violation. We talked to Mr. Geiske from the State Farm Bureau. He informed the MPCA that we had grassed waterways, and the fellow who wrote the letter of warning knew we had a grass waterway, and he still gave the letter of warning. Who's interpreting these laws? How are they being clear? They never told us about having a berm around a sinkhole before. Why wasn't that presented to agricultural owners? And then again, we tried to apply for our next expansion this spring. We found out we needed a DNR permit for water allocation permit, which, because we were using over 5 million gallons now. The permit cost $150, water meter $600, $250 for installation. It's a $1,000 new tax on us, folks, plus an annual usage fee. And then, go figure this. I presented sent the application in for the local DNR office the 1st of August. 28 days later, I'd still not received a reply whether they received the application or not. They said they were backlogged. Sorry, 2 days later, I had the next process. You have to send it to the state DNR for the billing and the payment. I sent it to the state DNR. About the 1st of September, 21 days later, I still hadn't received notice if they'd received the check or the permit. So there's another, 3 weeks the DNR held up. It's not right, folks. We hired an engineer at one time. It cost us $17,000 for a new pit. $800,000 doesn't fit in our budget. Sorry. Ultimately, this is my conclusion. People cannot afford the increased cost in the time of the permitting process. There's increased paperwork and hidden taxes in the process. Water quality is suffering because we are losing hay ground and pasture land as people decide not to have livestock with a related complexity. To go along with this, small towns such as Lewiston, every time we lose a livestock operation, that hinders our services rendered in town. It's a multiplication effect. We also understand by 2050 we need to increase dairy production by 58% to keep up the needs for our population. We have lost over 1,000 cows in Winona County dairy alone this last year. We are going in the wrong direction. As you can see, the end, is my conclusion. Helpful hints: improve communication about the changes in the rules. Clear rules based on solid research from the Extension Service, not someone's ideas or suggestions. Improved efficiency so we can get a response in 7 days, especially from the DNR. That's poor business.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ward. I have to say you have an excellent presentation here. You did a good job putting this together and a good job describing it. And I want all of you to know this is going into our record here. And the commissioner's kind enough to stay here and listen to these comments. And again, a lot of this is not under your watch, Commissioner. I don't think anyone means to say that. The point we're trying to get to is we've got some problems here and we need to work on this and figure out how we're going to fix this. And we're, we want to work with you and your agency and the others to do that too. So a very good presentation, Mr. Works.
Will we have a feedback from this committee sometime or not? Or?
Yes, you will.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Hi, how are you doing today?
Oh, not too bad.
Okay.
My name is Bob Marg. I'm from Altura, Minnesota. I'm not one of the large producers that has all the trouble that way. I had trouble I've had soil and water out three different guys over the last 15 years, which have stated that I have nothing that they can do better on my farm. I've always considered myself an environmentalist. We've put in a settlement pond and a grass filter strip for any manure runoff back in 1970, which is a long time before we would have had to do anything. I had worked the feedlot rules for Winona County Township Association for 3.5 years. MPCA basically forced me off that by coming after me. I got a milk house water bill passed. 7 days after I had it passed, Rod Massey from MPCA called me up and said, "You think you can pull shit? Just wait and see what I can do." Then they wanted a meeting on my place. Gene Pulowski said, "Yes, let's have a meeting on there." They set up the meeting. The only thing is they set it up for a day when legislature was in session voting on issues. Gene Pulowski said this was purposely set up this way. He says, "Get some people there. Have the meeting, but get some people there." Yeah, I got Neil Broadwater, the county extension agent, and one other guy that came. Ron Leaf from Pollution Control came down from the city. Jerry Hildebrandt from Rochester office, and our county feedlot officer, Mark Gernis. At that meeting, I left Mark Gernis know right away that he had already said my lot was good as is twice, and all of a sudden it's not. We went and checked the whole lot over. We come back into the milk house because there was snow on the ground. It was in beginning of March. And Ron Leaf spoke up first, and he says, "I think you have a good operation just the way it is. If there would happen to be a little discharge in early spring, high water flow and low water temperatures will digest it." Well, then Jerry Hildebrandt had a look on his face like somebody just stole his candy bar. And he said, oh, I can't quite agree with that. He said, I got to come in spring and check that there's grass in your filter strip. Well, they showed up in spring 3 days after the snowmelt, even though pollution control has stated at Rochester meetings, because I attended a lot of meetings working on the feedlot rules, that we know these grass filter strips don't work well in early spring until the grass starts to grow. That's when they showed up. They also stated that we accept them because they're an excellent way of treatment most of the time. Well, when they showed up, it was a record, all-time record, one-day rain for the month of April at Rochester. Winona Station was flooded out. They went out, and they said they were going to check for the grass. Well, as I was just finishing up milking, and so I pulled the last milker, hung it up, went out to watch what they were doing. Well, I got out there. They were crawling through the fence to go into the lot area where I got it fenced off so no cattle can get in except for to graze off once in a while in summer. They were just crossing the fence as I come out of the barn. By the time I got out there, they were down by the water, but somehow Mark Gurnas had ended up on the other side of an 8-foot wide flow. Now, I don't think he can fly, and I don't think he can jump that far, so I say he stepped in it. I didn't see him step in it, but I don't see how else he got across it. They walked about 15, 20 paces down, still 50 to 75 feet from the end of my grass filter strip. They took a sample of water. And then they said, well, we can take it any place we want. Well, at the end of this grass filter strip, it deposits out into a field or into a grass pasture. Goes another 100 feet through there yet before it hits the ditch. Now, the next problem was they said it would take a week for me to get the results back. This was in April. In August, I got the results back. I was just barely above the standards under those conditions, and I was just barely above the standards. And they had the wrong date on the sample. So I talked to Bill Queasley, Representative Queasley, and he said, send him a letter. Tell him that you don't believe this is the right sample because it's the wrong dates, and give him 14 days to retest, which I did. I got a call back from Rod Massey again, laughing at me and saying, hey, you didn't really like your water sample, did you? And I says, well, considering they took it in the wrong place and it's the wrong date on it, we can do whatever we want with it, he said. Well, I'd like to see him enforce that in court. The only way I got out from underneath MPCA was somebody you probably know. It's Steve Swigum came out to my place. Now, he come out, he looked everything over, and he says, I can't believe that they're harassing somebody like you that's at this small of operation. 26 cows, 30 steers I fatten a year, and I was raising about 200 pigs a year, farrow to finish. And he says, I'll make a few phone calls. I bet you don't hear from them again. Well, I haven't. But the other thing I found out later on was actually Mark Gurnas and Jerry Hildebrandt had gone up to the guy I was working with soil and water. Told him nothing was to be right on my farm. Everything was to cost as much as possible. I found this out because one guy that works up there that knows me well, that's been to my farm, that sees what good operation I do, called me up. And he says, if you give my name, he says, I'm history because they will fire me. But I told all this to Steve Swigum, and that's how I got MPC off my back. Now, I want my son to come in with me. He's 21 years old. I'm trying to get him in with me. I want to expand a little bit. Who do I believe? I can't trust pollution control. I can't trust the feedlot officer, and now I can't trust soil and water. Where do I go to get a permit? I'd really like to know. I mean,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mark. Thank you. And that's what you told us, Senator Miller and I, when we saw you earlier on.
Down in Rushford.
Yes. In Rushford, yes. So, thanks a lot for coming up to testify. Appreciate it. Thanks. Mr. Ingvaldson?
I just have one last comment. They mentioned they had talked a little bit about the AAWs, and I guess I really would like everyone to really think about when they were using their interpretations of EAWs. The EAWs, once they took place in the 1990s, since then the dairy in Minnesota has basically consistently gone backwards since that has happened. State of Minnesota has kind of gone from fifth place down to seventh place, and it's on the verge of heading to eighth place in production nationally. Can anyone tell me on this committee if there's anything else that's in causing that to happen other than the actions of MPCA anymore? Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, thanks to everyone that testified. Again, sorry the meeting went on so long, but again, important things we're talking about, and it was for you all, for the folks that traveled a ways, I was encouraged to see the Senate. So many of the senators ask questions and want to get, an understanding of what's going on now and what the plans are for the future. And I appreciate the commissioner and you folks from the agency coming in and talking to us. And you can see that, this is what we hear when we're out there in the countryside visiting with folks. And so we're very anxious to work with you, commissioner, and the other folks here and the other departments on trying to keep Minnesota going and strong. I hate to hear this from time to time again that it's difficult to encourage the younger folks to farm and to get them started, and it's frustrating and that's very disturbing to me. So with that, again, I really appreciate everyone coming in today and testifying. We've got work ahead of us, Commissioner. I look forward to working with you and other agencies. And with that, we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much.